You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Wednesday, January 13th, 2016, from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and I'm in Chicago this week hosting Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So that means there won't be a show tomorrow. But today, the big news out of Chicago is that the Cook County Jail went on lockdown. Why? Was it a riot? Was it contraband? No, it was an onside kick. It turns out that often after a big sporting event that goes late the night before, Cook County correction officers just don't show. Like after the Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather fight, 650 officers didn't show. And after the Super Bowl, almost 1,000 officers didn't show, and it cost the county $250,000. John Fritchie, who's the Cook County commissioner, says, yeah, maybe if it was just one or two sporting events where you get these no-shows, that'd be one thing. But he's beginning to think whenever a sporting event goes late, he's going to have a problem. So they have to punish the prisoners. They have to put them on lockdown, restrict their movements, because, like I said, Nick Saban decided to execute a beautiful onside kick in the national championship game. The ratings, I looked it up, the ratings of the national championship game. I mean, we're in Chicago. We're not in Alabama. We're not talking about lockdown at a Birmingham jail. Greatest Martin Luther King speech ever. We're talking about a place hundreds of miles from South Carolina and Alabama where these two teams play. And the ratings were a little below national average. Still, so many officers don't show. And you'd think that working at the Cook County Jail wouldn't be that bad. I mean, you got Jake, you got Elwood, Donald Duck Dunn on bass. They're playing songs all the time. I base a lot of my knowledge of jurisprudence on the movies. Anyway, on the show today, I will spiel about the State of the Union. I think it's also kind of on lockdown. But first, Maria Konnikova here talking about her new book, The Confidence Game. In The Usual Suspects, they tell you that the greatest con the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. That was actually a quote by Charles Baudelaire, who actually said the loveliest trick of the devil is to persuade you that he does not exist. And in fact, I misquoted The Usual Suspects on purpose because it was the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. But it was a con. It was a long con. My question now, after reading The Confidence Game, I've been talking about it a lot because Maria Konnikova comes on the show and we talk about, is this bullshit? And I always say she's the author of The Confidence Game. Well, then I read The Confidence Game. And what Maria gets me to do is to think not about the devil's trick or the devil's con, but us. How have we been conned by that devil, by all these devils? What's going on in our head that these devils are exploiting? And that is the trick of the book. Maria Konnikova is here.
Hey, Mike.
So this is a look at cons, which are books about them and examinations of them are in no short supply. But this is really the first one in almost 100 years that looks at all the evidence for why we get conned, as opposed to, you know, here's the structure of a con, here's the layout of a con. Those other books that do that touch on this, but this is mainly inside the minds of the conned.
Absolutely. And that's exactly why I wanted to write the book, to figure out how is it that such brilliant, intelligent people like you and mm-hmm. like me and like Andrea fall for these things that in retrospect seem totally implausible, unbelievable. You think, okay, how stupid do you have to be
right.
to fall for something like that?
And it's not stupid.
No,
it's human,
not at all.
And as you point out, it's often a little vulnerable. Right. There are times when like a three card Monty game.
Yeah.
I've never been conned by three card Monty because I think when it was really prevalent in New York, I was a little too young mm-hmm. to be walking around and putting down my own $5. But you talk about the tourist who needed her $3 for her
yeah.
share of the Chinese food.
Yep.
She comes to New York and all those things add up to make her lose her money.
Absolutely. And you know, this woman, she's a PhD, sociology PhD, was a senior editor at Scientific American, not a stupid person. But if you're not someone, first of all, if you're not someone who's familiar with Three Card Monty, and to New Yorkers, it seems really silly, but a lot of people aren't. They don't know what this is. And even if you are, this is the funny thing is, the funny thing is that even if you're familiar with it, sometimes you play anyway because you still think that you can beat them because they make you think that.
They do. They put in little things. They understand psychology so well.
They do.
So one of the things they do is they have a plant who looks like he wins.
Yep.
And then sometimes I've even seen it where that guy will kind of run away and it seems like the guy running the Monty gets upset. So they really make it seem like the con is I'm so good at what I do that you can't beat me. That's not the con. In fact, anyone who you ever see taking money off a three-card Monty table is in on the game, period, end stop. There's no exception.
Absolutely. The best cons, even when they're short, like Three Card Monty, they tell a full story.
Right.
And they have that drama, that dramatic sweep, and you're part of it. And you get really emotionally invested in this.
Con men, first of all, mostly men. Famous ones are.
A lot of them are men. And a lot of people ask, you know, are con artists psychopaths? So a lot of them are. And most, almost all psychopaths are male.
Yes.
Fewer than 1% are female.
But as you point out, so psychopathy is one of the three,
one,
the dark triad?
Yes.
Yeah, and the other two are being Machiavellian and
narcissistic.
Narcissistic.
Yes.
Machiavellian and narcissists, more men than women?
Yes, actually,
okay.
Especially for Machiavellianism. For narcissism, I'm not sure. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. But so there are a lot of men con artists, but some of the very good imposter con artists are females because they're very good as well at getting people to trust them. I mean, that's why some of the best spies are women. If you look at historical examples, most spies are men, but some of the ones who were the absolute best spies were women.
But you tend to doubt that psychopathy is the big explanation.
Yeah.
You think Machiavellian is more, right?
I think so.
I think, hey, listeners, do you know this? Have you read The Prince? If not, I'll pause. Okay, you're back. You read The Prince. But in psychology, how do they define it?
Actually, quite similarly. It's someone who is very good at persuading others to do what that person wants you to do. And so it's someone who is basically an incredibly gifted persuader.
Yeah.
And that's what con artists are at a very fundamental level.
But psychopaths lack empathy.
Yes.
Do Machiavellians lack something?
No, Machiavellians are just usually quite ruthless.
Yeah.
They could be psychopaths as well, but they don't need to be.
If you have two of the three of the dark tribe.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And you can also be a psychopath and not become a con artist and be a very decent human being. I wrote about the case of a neuroscientist, James Fallon, who found out during the course of his research that he was a psychopath.
Yeah.
He had no idea.
One of his randomized trials kept saying, wow, reading in the non-psychopath group actually is a psychopath. And then he says, I got to tell the guy.
Yes,
and then he looks up to see who the guy is.
And it's him.
And the call is coming from inside the house.
That's exactly right.
This is a little off the topic of comment. Why is he a psychopath yet a more than less, not even benign, like actually a force for good in the world? How is that guy both?
People mistake psychopathy for necessarily evil human being. All it means is that you have a brain that's different, that's actually physically different, and that processes emotions in a very different way. There's a saying among psychologists and among scientists in general that genes load the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. And that genetic predisposition, the fact that your brain is like this, doesn't mean that you're going to actually become someone who's a really terrible human being.
Right.
And he actually points out in his book that he realized after he found out that he was a psychopath that he had a lot of emotional problems. When he told his wife said, yeah, I'm not at all surprised.
Yeah.
His friends weren't at all surprised. After he knew, he started trying to compensate for them. But they always just he was always just a little cold and distant.
So the great imposter, who's Damara, is that
how?
So what's his,
Ferdinand Waldo Damara.
Which isn't even a con artist. That's his real name.
That's his
real
name.
That's the name
you'd invent. Isn't that amazing?
That's awesome. And this guy.
Where's Waldo?
This guy was on Johnny Carson. This guy got extremely
famous. He was,
famous.
And he was on Groucho Marx's show.
Yes. So people of my dad's generation, for him, that is the go-to con artist you talk about. And you talk to someone who's over 60, kind of everyone knows, oh, yeah, the great imposter.
Right.
He pretended to be a surgeon. He pretended to be a monk. I, because maybe he was on Johnny Carson, it was always presented as kind of funny and kind of comical. You're right. Like, think of all the skills this guy had, and he really could have done any of those things.
He could have,
I think he didn't want to delay gratification.
He didn't.
And he didn't want to do just one of those things.
Yep.
It's very hard to be a monk and a surgeon. Anna, what else did he say he was?
He was a prison warden in Texas.
Yes.
He almost got a contract to build a bridge in South America because he said he was an engineer. By the way, can you imagine what would have happened had he gotten that contract?
Yeah, maybe the Johnny Carson appearances next to Charo wouldn't have been quite so delightful. But is he, of the dark triad, what did he have? And is there a, I mean, did he hurt people? Is
he
there
did.
A nefarious side to him?
I actually think he had all three.
Yeah.
Because think about what kind of person you have to be to not only pretend to be a surgeon, but then to actually conduct surgery
and look, they're
on
gonna
real
staff,
human beings.
And in World War II, or was it?
Korean War.
In the Korean War, they'd have staffed his ship with a surgeon.
Yeah.
So when all those sailors got hurt, would you really rather have them with Damara or an actual surgeon? Although, he had pretty good outcomes for his surgery.
As far as we know.
Yeah.
Because all of these people then went off the ship. No
right.
one died under the
and
knife.
And also, the propaganda, the pro-U.S. propaganda at the time didn't
yes.
want to maybe document the fact
right.
that they hired this guy who was lying and he wound up killing people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so I think you have to be psychopathic to do that because you're literally playing with lives.
Yeah.
And then he wanted to deliver the baby of his biographer.
The stuff with his biographer is fascinating. The most fascinating.
I thought so, too. And his biographer, by the way, doesn't realize what's happening.
Yeah.
So I was able to, his daughters were awesome. And he gave me
the
files.
Biographer's daughters.
Yeah, the biographer's daughters. Damar didn't have any kids. So Crichton's daughters were wonderful and gave me just files and files and files. And their dad kept meticulous records of all of their correspondence over multiple decades. And none of this stuff is in the book because this guy didn't realize that he was just being conned over and over. And it's insane.
He kept going back. Damara kept like suing his biographer.
He sued him twice. He
and stole, Damara can. The biographer from Crichton loves
he
him.
He stole his identity.
Yeah.
He almost killed his wife
yeah.
by delivering her baby incorrectly. He didn't. That didn't actually happen, but he could have.
Yeah.
He got him to pay for his education.
Yeah.
After which point he ran off and committed another con. And not just a con, but he was accused of molesting young boys. Then he got Crichton to buy him a car. All of these things kept happening. He never went straight. And Crichton just kept believing in him and giving him great recommendation letters. You should see some of the stuff the guy says about him.
Well, you have so many examples where con artists commit a con and then they're reconfronted by the people they tricked and they think, oh no, the jig is up. And the people want to go in
yes.
again.
Yes.
Like once a con is executed properly, it's almost like you've got a certain hook into those people for life.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think that the greatest con artists that we will ever meet are ourselves, of our own minds.
Probably
because
necessary to get
exactly,
through the day.
Exactly. Yeah. And self-deception is so strong that we will do everything necessary to rationalize why certain things happened. And so we don't learn. We don't say, oh, I was stupid. I was conned. You say, oh, bad luck, but this guy's great. You know, I would trust him again 100%. He's a great investor. He's a great whatever it is. And we just keep coming back for more because we've convinced ourselves that we were not wrong.
On local news, I hear stories how to spot a con. And I'm sure to some extent, maybe someone is thinking of marketing your book that way or some interviewer will say, well, tell our listeners how to spot a con. If someone is interested in knowing how to spot a con, I don't know that they are primed to being conned. Maybe they could tell their grandmother, oh, I just read about this. But
right.
the kind of person who answers those fishing expeditions, I'm a Nigerian prince, they're not the kind of person who's actually interested in spotting a con, I don't think.
No, that's absolutely right. And people wonder why those Nigerian prince emails are so poorly written.
Yeah.
And that's on purpose because they that way only the real suckers are going to respond because otherwise it would take too much effort to weed out the people who are really good targets.
You want a really low response rate.
So they want the low response rate because those low responders are going to be their best targets.
Well, what about street corner psychics? Because you have a lot in there.
Yeah.
And right now in New York State, there are a couple of psychics serving pretty long jail times, which is unprecedented. But it would seem that some are really good at separating people from tens of thousands of dollars. Are they operating on a different principle than the Nigerian prince scammers? Would they try to push everyone who comes in to give up as much money as they can?
No.
What's going on with them?
They're actually very good. All good con artists are really good readers of humanity. And so you can pretty easily spot someone who might be skeptical, but there's a little bit of open-mindedness there mm-hmm. versus someone who's just totally coming in on a lark with some friends. Oh, let's go get a psychic reading. For the people who just want that psychic reading, you just give them a psychic reading and you send them on your way. But for the people where you really sense that emotional vulnerability, I think that that's where they can really pounce and try to see. They test the ground. They don't say right away, you know, give me $10,000.
Mm-hmm. No,
they really build this up over time because you have to establish a relationship. You have to create drama. You have to tell a story. You have to establish that emotional rapport. And so a lot of them will work really hard to build that up. I went to a psychic when I was researching the book, and right away it was very funny to see this kind of the psychic operate on me and start pointing out similarities between us and getting information out of me. And I was there, obviously, knowing exactly what I was doing. But he, and this was a he, even though a lot of them are women, he was very good at kind of building rapport. I came out of it thinking he's a really nice guy and quite perceptive.
Well, but there's, okay, so they're building rapport just to become the kind of great psychic who could charge $100 and only say it's for entertainment mm-hmm. purposes, right? Oh, that guy was good. He knew stuff about me.
Right.
Did you get the sense that this guy would have pushed it and gotten thousands of dollars out of you if he could? How would we know that?
This particular guy, no. Yeah. I don't think he would have. He did tarot card readings, which is only one very specific kind of psychic. I didn't get any, you know, for $1,000, I'll clean your aura.
Yeah.
But there are others who are that way. I don't know, though, that I'd be able to spot one from the other, to be perfectly honest. So I don't know if I'm in the best place to give that advice, because until it's happening to you, and until you're the one who's actually saying, you know what, I think psychics are total bullshit, mm-hmm. but this one seems to be the real deal. And that's what they want all of you to say. And a lot of them will even say, psychics are bullshit, I know that, but I've just, you know, I have a gift.
Maria Konnikova, you know her. She's been on the show before, but her new book is The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you, Mike.
And now the spiel, swan song. So they said that the State of the Union wasn't going to be like other State of the Unions. It wasn't just going to be a laundry list. And yet, at least on the ABC broadcast, there was a list, maybe not a laundry list, more like the list that they put on the ESPN show PTI of topics that Obama was going to get to. And those topics were things like healthcare, economy, military. I did not see, you know, hilarious Steve Harvey joke, dunk on a 9.5-inch rim, plank. It was pretty much like a regular State of the Union. With that weird specter of standing ovations where only half the place stands, I know we're used to this during States of the Union or State of the Union addresses, but imagine if you went to a live performance, it was an excellent Broadway show, it's Hamilton, and afterwards exactly half of the audience stands and just in large, clearly defined pockets are just sitting on their hands. You're like, are these people from another country who don't understand the contagion of the standing ovation or the fact that standing ovations actually exist just because the people in the front two rows decide to stand and then everyone else is roped into it? It is a weird standing ovation thing they got going in the State of the Union. And they also had the thing with people in the gallery, although Obama didn't shout them out. You had a community college student, just identified as community college student, Jennifer Bragdon, community college student. That was her credential. You know, I know that Kim Davis, the Kentucky County Clerk, was also in the back of the room. I think she has probably some community college under her belt, just like Jennifer Bragdon. Jennifer Bragdon is not a community college graduate yet. She's a student. She was seated next to the Microsoft CEO. Maybe she leaned over to him like Paul Ryan and Biden leaned over and whispered, "Hey, you got any gigs open?" Well, we'll probably unveil a new operating system once you get that associate's degree. But till then, maybe Yahoo? Maybe Yahoo would be good for you? I thought the State of the Union, I thought Obama did a pretty good job. You know, I'm going to pursue this idea that struck me a little in more depth later on in this space. But I think you make the case that he's the greatest communicator of the last few decades. But you could also make an equally compelling case that he is among the worst communicators because, like he says, the State of the Union is strong. We have the strongest economy of any major nation, and no one knows it. So how great a communicator are you if everyone says, what a great speech, what flourishes, but no one knows the actual accomplishments you made? After the State of the Union, there was the Republican response. Nikki Haley gave it, and she did a good job. She, for instance, talked about the national debt. Obama didn't do that. I do not think this is an existential threat, but I think it's something that you'd want the opposition party, if you were a fan of the opposition party or an opponent of the president, to raise. And in fact, she got plaudits from mainstream Republicans, even David Axelrod, former White House advisor. But the non-mainstream Republicans, the far rightward Republicans, did not like what she had to say. She seemed to be criticizing Trump, and that is something that you can't do. Another far right-wing Republican, Ted Cruz, was invited on NBC to comment on the State of the Union. Turns out he didn't like it.
It was sadly, I think it was less a State of the Union than it was a state of denial.
Of Ted Cruz's complaints is the old complaint that Barack Obama didn't even use the phrase Islamic terrorism. Because, you know, he's never used that phrase, and it might seem a little weird to bust it out in your last State of the Union. I'm gonna change course and throw the Islamic in there. Nikki Haley also did not use the phrase Islamic terrorism. Ted Cruz's other complaints are the things that Obama didn't talk about. He didn't talk about that Philadelphia cop shot by the ISIS sympathizer. He didn't talk about the American sailors who were detained in Iran. Apparently, Ted Cruz looking for the State of the Union to have a strong overlap with that day's headlines, trending on AOL's homepage. In fact, by this morning, those American sailors were released. I don't know. I'm thinking maybe Obama, someone from the Navy said, don't worry, we're working this out. But the things that Ted Cruz seemed to want Obama to talk about, he didn't talk about Paris. He didn't talk about the Philly cop. He didn't talk about San Bernardino. Oh, I get it. Ted Cruz wasn't thinking about the American State of the Union. He was thinking about the State of the Islamic State. He was thinking about Abu al-Baghdadi's State of the Union, because I'm sure he'd talk about Paris and he'd talk about San Bernardino. The State of the Union should not be a list of bummers. And now, in my State of the Union, I am going to do it a little differently. I'm going to talk about all the bad things that went on while I was president. I'm going to make it so that the Venn diagram of the State of the Union and the stump speech of my biggest opponents has a huge overlap. It's going to pretty much look the same. That's how I'm going to do the State of the Union. Forget this laundry list on the screen on ABC that says economy and military. It's going to say Obamacare stinks. It's going to say healthcare.gov sign up. It's going to say, am I really not a Kenyan? That's what my State of the Union is going to be to satisfy Ted Cruz. Also, Islamic terror. Mic drop. Obama out. That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Andrea Salenzi, who put The Gist on lockdown after Nicki Minaj was on Fallon last night. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lickteig, who did not show up to work today after a very special episode of Love, Sydney. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, but you wouldn't know it by his no-show today. Then again, Late Local News featured a report that you and your family won't want to miss on dirty hotel rooms. The Gist, phoning it in, yeah. But we do have a case of DD7 that we bought after a late-night infomercial. It was very compelling. Oomperoodeperoodooperoo, and thanks for listening.